Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser, sitting in today for Ron Ropiak. We're focusing today on the impact that the opioid crisis has had in Connecticut. According to the State Department of Public Health, a Connecticut resident is more likely to die of an unintentional drug overdose than in a car accident. Not too long ago, those numbers were just about even, but the opioid crisis has changed that. Most opioid overdose deaths are linked to prescription painkillers and illicit opioids. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner projected that the number of accidental drug-related deaths in 2019 would be 1,088. That's 81 more than 2018. We begin today with the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Miriam E. Delphin-Rittman. She's been in charge of that department since 2015. The Commissioner is also an Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine. I spoke earlier with Commissioner Rittman via phone, and I asked her if the state knew how many people were struggling with opioid use disorder in 2019.
That's a hard number to get at because, you know, we know some people are going to their primary care physicians to get help with opioid use disorder as well. What we see in terms of the individuals coming into the DMIS treatment system is we've seen an increase in the number of individuals who are reporting that heroin or opioids are their primary substance of choice, that is a substance that they're struggling with.
And the folks who go to a GP, to their primary physicians, those are not the kinds of things that are reportable to the state, correct?
Right. So a primary care provider or somebody that's going to a physician with their own private insurance, so that would be outside of the DMIS system of care, and so we would not traditionally get that data. So an individual that's in private practice or anyone else outside of the public behavioral health system of care.
And what about the overdose rate in the state? Which way is that trending?
Some of the projections, as you mentioned, from the Office of the Chief State's Medical Examiner does suggest an increase in the number of overdoses compared to what we saw last year. We're watching that data closely. I mean, we've seen within the last 2 months, the numbers start to come down a little bit, but we're looking at those numbers. Right now, the official projections suggest that we might see more overdoses than we saw last year.
Any handle yet on why that is, or even why over the past couple of months you've seen it sort of level off?
One thing we think that's contributing to that pattern is the level of fentanyl that is being consumed by people. When we look at the data, about 78% of the overdoses that we've seen so far, fentanyl has been involved. And we know fentanyl is a highly addictive substance. It's about 100 times stronger than morphine. So even a very, very small amount could be deadly.
So while prescription drugs are still part of the problem, the synthetic opioids, like you mentioned, fentanyl, that's become a more common cause of overdose.
That's right. And in fact, sometimes what happens is individuals think they're taking heroin or think that they're taking a pill maybe that they somehow got other than from a physician. And what we're finding is increasingly heroin is tainted with fentanyl, and fentanyl is also pressed into pills that mimic OxyContin and other opioids. Again, just a very small amount of fentanyl is deadly because it's so much stronger than heroin and other pills, opioid-related pills.
You mentioned that you have seen an increase in the number of people seeking help to deal with their use disorders. What type of services are they offered? What type of services are they looking for?
Yeah. So, you know, we offer a broad range of services for people that are struggling with substance abuse and opioid addiction. And one thing we believe is that, you know, there are just multiple pathways to recovery. And as a function of that, we've tried to really put a number of different services and supports in place. So all the way from, a person may need detox, another person may need residential or outpatient services. Some people may request medication-assisted treatment, so that is being treated with either methadone or buprenorphine or Vivitrol. Those are substances that a person can take if they're struggling with an opioid use disorder that helps to reduce cravings and helps them to, in many ways, continue on with their life. They often can go to work, can participate in their families or community, don't need to be in an inpatient setting long term. So medication-assisted treatment, you know, along with other recovery services and supports, has been identified as one evidence-based practice for helping people move into long-term recovery.
How about resources in the states? Are they being stretched by this problem, or are things, I guess you would say, comfortable at this point? You're able to deal with all of the people coming to you for help.
Yeah, so we have been able to work with the people that are seeking services, and we're so grateful for the federal funds that we receive. We've received a SAMHSA grant, $11.1 million each year for 2 years. We have several other federal grants, but those have absolutely helped us to develop a number of innovative programs to meet the needs of people that are seeking services. We even do innovative things. Like, we know not all people are necessarily going to come in for services, and so we have programs where we offer mobile medication-assisted treatment. So we have vans and now even an RV that drives around in communities to try to help engage people and start them on medication-assisted treatment, and give them information about other services and supports, and also provides them with harm reduction supplies, like Narcan or fentanyl test strips even.
One of the questions I was going to ask you had to do with locations of facilities that do deal with folks who come in with the problem. It seems to be centered in cities with past drug problems. That seems to be the case. But the opioid crisis really cuts across most boundaries. So suburbs, rural areas, there are people there, too, struggling with this. It sounds like your mobile solution deals with that.
Yeah, it really does. And we've worked to actually develop a service system that includes services and supports not just in the urban areas. So we currently have a number of walk-in assessment centers all around the state, including in rural areas, where a person can walk in, receive an assessment, and be linked with the appropriate level of care. And again, those are all over the state, including rural areas. But then, you know, the other thing we have an access line. It's our 1-800 number, and it's 1-800-563-4086. And that's a line where a person can call, receive an assessment over the phone, and if they need detox and need a ride to detox, we will come and pick them up, because we don't want transportation to be a barrier. We'll come and pick them up and give them a ride to detox to ensure that they get connected to services and the supports that they need.
What about online? Is there a place people should go to find information?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we recently launched our Live Loud campaign. So that's at www.liveloud.org. And that's a campaign that's geared towards individuals who are struggling, family members. There is a wealth of information there at that website, including a link to a number of different websites, but one where a person can access and learn where the drop boxes are, so the medication drop boxes. There's a link to that on the Live Loud. There's also a link to where in their community they can get Narcan, so, you know, which pharmacies within their community supply Narcan. The website also has information about where different support groups, where different walk-in assessment centers are, supports for families. There are grief groups and other support groups that are available for families, and the Live Loud website also includes information about that as well.
Have you noticed any patterns in terms of demographics of those seeking help, age, gender, race, economic level?
In terms of people seeking help, it sort of mirrors what we're seeing with the epidemic. It's across the board. We see people in a range of different age groups, a range of different racial and ethnic and demographic groups, males and females. As we've seen, people across the state have been impacted by that, by the epidemic. And that's what we see in terms of people accessing services as well.
You made a very interesting comment not too long ago. You said that Connecticut, quote, must also continue our work to break down the silos of addiction, mental health, and physical health, focusing on the whole person. I'm wondering, what do you mean by silos of addiction, and how does that hinder people seeking to recover from these use disorders?
Yeah. I mean, one thing we know is that, you know, sometimes mental health services exist separate from addiction services. And so one thing that we've been working on within our system, certainly across our local mental health authorities, so the sites within communities where people can get help for mental health issues, many of those sites now are also equipped and able to help people struggling with opioid use and other substance use disorders as well. They can help to connect people to services and supports, and so that's really what I mean by that. And increasingly, that's been a goal within the DMIS system, to take a whole health approach, in that we want to be able to address mental health issues, addiction, as well as primary care. You know, we want to be able to connect people and work to connect people to primary care services when that's needed as well, because we know a person's physical health does impact their mental health and vice versa.
We've been talking about people seeking help when the problem has already occurred, and I'm wondering, is the state involved in any education efforts to help prevent people from getting involved with this kind of a problem at the very beginning?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So there are a number of prevention initiatives that we have in place. We call these groups the Regional Behavioral Health Action Organizations. They do trainings and awareness building events all over the state to help raise awareness. There's also been a number of community forums and other community groups that are putting on forums and other community education events to help educate parents, other individuals who maybe are in recovery and are looking to continue to move into long-term recovery. So we really advertise far and wide in terms of individuals to attend those programs. And they essentially focus on the dangers of opioids and how to access services and supports if an individual is struggling.
Commissioner, thanks very much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Miriam Delphin Rittman is the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Coming up on The Full Story, we'll hear from professionals on the front lines of treating people with opioid use disorder. Stay with us. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser, sitting in today for Ron Ropiak. We continue our conversation about the opioid crisis in Connecticut with a look at recovery services in the state. Demand for these services is growing, but making them available can be a challenge. We have two guests who are dealing with that challenge. First is Dr. J. Craig Allen. He's the Vice President of Addiction Services with Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. He's also the Medical Director of the Rushford Treatment Center in Middletown. I spoke with Dr. Allen earlier, and I asked him when he began to see a rise in demand for treatment in Connecticut.
The need for this treatment has been there since the 50s, but when we started to see this tremendous increase in opioid overdoses, a quadrupling of the number of people who are dying from opioid overdoses over a time span of 4 years, from the 2012 to 2016. That was when we had to do everything possible. We always should have been strongly encouraging people with an opioid use disorder to get a medication-assisted treatment, but there was a tremendous amount of variability in making those recommendations because of lack of education and training in the lay community, but also in the healthcare community. So doctors going through medical school typically would get very little education around substance use disorders, and maybe less about opioid use disorders and the effectiveness of medication-assisted treatments. Methadone, which is a treatment for opioid use disorder, has been around since the 50s and 60s. But most healthcare providers don't get experience with methadone because the way the laws were developed back then, these methadone dispensaries were separate from healthcare systems usually, and separate from hospital systems, and out of sight, out of mind, unfortunately. So when this huge rise in overdoses took place across the country and in Connecticut with that quadrupling of deaths, there was an urgent attempt to get everybody up to speed on identification and intervention for this life-threatening disorder.
How do people find their way to you or really any other treatment centers? Does it happen typically at the ER if someone has, you know, experienced an overdose, or if someone just knows they have a problem with opioids and they've not gone to the ER, they are recommended or referred? How, right. how does that happen?
We are continuously working on developing pathways. You know, maybe you've heard the phrase, there's no wrong door, mm-hmm. you know, to enter into the system. So yes, you can call Rushford and we will give you an appointment. You can also go to an emergency room and say, I want treatment. Some emergency rooms can start you on the treatment. And the reason it's so important to start someone on treatment when they're ready is that this is a chronic and recurring disease. It's really, really important to have the best outcomes. And so we measure things like what percentage of people are continuing to stay engaged after the first appointment, after the first 30 days, after the first 60 days. And what studies show is that the sooner someone gets medication, the longer they stay engaged in treatment. And those studies seem to bear out for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. We don't have a lot of data beyond that around engagement. It's not the obvious that everybody who needs treatment calls on the phone, sets up an appointment, and comes on in. People that are in the throes of addiction, you know, part of the brain that's affected is the prefrontal cortex, and that's planning, risk management, prioritization. Those are the things you need that need to be working in order to call someone, set up an appointment, and keep that appointment. So if you've got access, if you've got the opportunity, then engage with that person. And as I mentioned before, if you get them on medications in the emergency room, or you get them on medications if they're on one of the medical floors, then connect them with outpatient services. They are much, much more likely to follow up, and the outcomes are much better.
Dr. Allen, you were interviewed by the Connecticut Health iTeam news site a while back about the use of methadone. You had touched on that earlier in our conversation here, to treat addiction. And you said in that article, quote, methadone should be offered everywhere. Yes, there needs to be regulation and oversight and training, but it should be much easier for people to access it. Why is that so important?
Well, you know, methadone has been around for a while. It is effective in treating opioid use disorder. It decreases overdoses. It gets people back into the community. It gives them their lives back and gives their families and loved ones the person that they've known and relied on. That person's able to function again in the community. There are three FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder. One of them is methadone. Methadone is listed as, by the World Health Organization, listed as one of the top 10 essential medications in the world. So there's methadone, there's buprenorphine-based medications, and the name brand there that people are familiar with is Suboxone. And then there is Trexone, and there's an extended release form that comes in a month with injection. And people will say to me, so which one's the best one to use? Truly, in real life, on the streets, and in practice, the best medication is the one that the person who has the opioid use disorder is willing to take. It's incredibly important to be able to offer all three of these medications and not be overly focused on one or the other, because not everybody wants any one of these medications, yet all of these medications can be effective for somebody. The problem with these methadone dispensaries is that they tend to be located in specific and few areas across the state, oftentimes in parts of town that allow for it. And so they might be neighborhoods that some people might not want to be in. There's some stigma and discrimination around people sometimes who go to these places. And so, you know, there are multiple challenges with methadone.
This is a problem that's not limited to specific geographies, though. Do you think suburban and rural populations are really underserved when it comes to addiction services?
Yeah, absolutely. Not just methadone, you know, more rural populations. having access to these buprenorphine-based medications like Suboxone is limited as well. And that's not because of regulatory reasons. That's because of the comfort level of healthcare providers in that area in prescribing this medication. Education around substance use disorders, opioid use disorders, and the treatments available for those disorders isn't something that's given enough emphasis in medical school or graduate medical education, and likewise in nursing programs for physician assistants, and programs for nurse practitioners. So people don't get that education, and they have a fear and a concern about using these medications. And there is if you don't know a lot about how to manage and treat a disorder, then there's a tendency to shy away from people who present with that disorder. And, you know, oftentimes I'll hear, well, you know, I don't want a lot of those types of people here in my practice. And I try to, you know, emphasize to providers, those types of people are the people you see, because substance use disorders, opioid use disorders, they really don't only affect some specific type of person. They affect people from all different socioeconomic groups, all different ethnic groups. In anybody's outpatient primary care practice, there's going to be 15-20% of the patients that at some point are suffering from a substance use disorder. And learning as much as you can about those disorders is crucial.
Before we finish up, I'd like to circle back and ask you one more question about the type of treatment. And you mentioned there were three medications that people, you know, are somewhat reluctant to take at times. Is there a treatment option that does not involve medication?
Yes, certainly. And when I talk about medication, I believe that the best treatment involves some type of therapy along with the medication, and that ultimately what works best is people who are able to develop the skills that they need to first manage cravings and urges to use, and then to be able to manage those situations that might drive those cravings and urges, and be able to manage underlying problems that they may have with anxiety or depression or pain or other medical issues. The types of therapies that appear to be helpful can either be individual or group therapies with a focus on cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement treatments. If people are not going to use medication, and people do get better without using medication, but in those situations, it's really, really, really important to have a safety plan in place, know the strategies you're going to use if, in fact, you do have a relapse, and have supportive people around you, certainly to have naloxone around if, gosh forbid, you relapse, and a lot of people do. It's a chronic recurring disease, that you're not going to die from that relapse. But, you know, that's becoming dicier and dicier with these really, really potent synthetic opioid medications.
Dr. J. Craig Allen is Vice President of Addiction Services with Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network, and he's the Medical Director of the Rushford Treatment Center in Middletown, Connecticut. Dr. Allen, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Really appreciate you having me on. Thank you, Tom.
If you're just tuning into the full story here on WSHU Public Radio, we're talking about where people with opioid use disorder can get help. Our next guest is Lynn Madden. She's the Chief Executive Officer of APT Foundation. It has several clinics that offer multiple services in New Haven and Bridgeport. When I spoke earlier with Lynn Madden, I asked her for an assessment of the opioid crisis.
I can tell you just in broad strokes that the opioid epidemic, as you mentioned, is very problematic in the United States. We have over 100 people a day dying of overdose, and the state of Connecticut is certainly not exempt from that. So we continue to struggle here in Connecticut trying to meet the demand for treatment and really to measurably slow down the epidemic itself.
What is it that you do for people seeking help from your clinics? You mentioned lots of people coming in. How many people do come to you looking for that kind of help?
We have a kind of unique walk-in evaluation service here at the Apt Foundation, and we do walk-in evaluation for people who refer themselves primarily for substance use and or mental health issues. We do that 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and we see about 200 people a month who walk through the door seeking treatment.
So they refer themselves. Do you also see people who have been referred from perhaps general practitioners or from other sources, from hospitals
certainly,
perhaps?
Most certainly. But one of the things that we've really specialized in here is open access or really easy access for people. So we have a very low threshold or low barrier access to our evaluation process.
How many clinics do you have?
We have five locations really in the sort of greater New Haven area. They are in West Haven, North Haven. We have residential treatment services here in New Haven. We have our access center and our primary care unit in New Haven. And then we also have another outpatient clinic location in New Haven.
And given the demand today, these days, do you have the resources that you need to meet that?
It's always a challenge to find the best qualified, committed people to work for us, so we are always looking. But yes, we have created a program model that we consider to be very elastic. If you have need for substance abuse treatment or mental health services, we will offer them to you. We offer them on the same day. And we basically stay here each day that we have evaluation available until everybody is seen and evaluated and is matched with some appropriate level of care.
How long have APT clinics been available to those seeking help?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because in April of 2020, the APT Foundation will turn 50 years old. So we were actually started in 1970. We are a nonprofit organization that was initially founded by members of the Yale University School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry. But very quickly thereafter became its own nonprofit organization with a separate board of directors.
Given the demand today, especially with the opioid use disorder crisis happening, have you had to change how you offer services over the years, or even the type of services that you offer as the crisis has worsened?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One of the most important things that we had to do, and that I wish that more organizations around the country were doing, is to really look at barriers to treatment, because the most important thing is to meet people in real time when they believe they need care. That's very important for every addictive disorder, not to have people wait, because it's difficult to capitalize on motivation that can be fleeting in the face of an addictive disorder. So that's one of the most important changes that we made. And we went to an all open access model in 2007. Since that time, we actually have grown from caring for about 1,300 people each year to just about 8,000 people each year.
Wow, that's quite a few. Can you measure your success at helping people away from opioids?
Certainly, we measure that success in any number of ways. One of them is really in getting people to continue to come into care, right? So that once you enter treatment, we try very hard to help you stay in treatment, because the research really shows that the longer you stay in treatment, the more likely you are to have a healthy and productive life going forward. So we have measures of that. We certainly have measures of other kinds of recovery domains, such as, you know, are you able to mitigate any occurring depression, for example, other health issues. We treat hepatitis C here as well, which is more prevalent in the community of persons that abuse substances.
I would imagine, given the numbers that you just mentioned, 8,000, it must be difficult to keep track of so many people who are looking to improve their condition.
Well, no, that's actually what we do, right? So we have 350 employees, and we have a medical record system that thankfully helps us very much with keeping track of people. So when you come in today, for example, if you were a person coming in today, and your record popped up, that chart would tell us, oh, Tom needs a treatment plan, or Tom should give a urinalysis, or we were a little worried about Tom the last time he came in. So our chart really helps us manage each of these persons in an individual way.
Our guest is Lynn Madden, the Chief Executive Officer of APT Foundation in New Haven. We'll continue our conversation right after this short break. This is The Full Story. Please stay with us. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Tom Kuser, sitting in today for Ron Ropiak. And we're talking with Lynn Madden, the Chief Executive Officer of APT Foundation in New Haven, about the challenges of providing recovery services in the midst of a growing opioid crisis. She told me that one treatment skill the APT clinics teach is self-management.
So part of getting better from any kind of addiction is to learn to manage yourself, to recognize when you're not feeling very well, or to recognize triggers of behaviors that you don't want to engage in any longer. So we really work very hard on self-management. And when people come to us, when patients come through the door, particularly as they start to do better, they tell us really what they need.
What about people who, for whatever reason, stop coming back, or they just no longer come through the front door? What happens to folks like that who I would think are at risk of relapsing?
So all addiction, by definition, they're chronic, long-term, relapsing, remitting illnesses, right? So the course of a person's recovery is very rarely linear, that you enter treatment and then you do well forever going forward. So you might think of it more like diabetes, right? When you enter treatment for diabetes, perhaps you don't even know you have it. There are different strategies that your team actually try, but most people don't do everything perfectly right from day one. They don't change their diet, start exercising, take all their medication right from day one. And they often, their numbers, which we track with a person who has diabetes, go up and down. So addictive disorders are very similar to that. So the average course for a person who enters a one-year period of recovery, let's talk about opioid use for just a moment, one-year period of non-use of opioids, the average person has been in and out of treatment between 5 and 7 times. That's the normal course of treatment. So it's not linear. What is the best predictor of coming into treatment is actually coming into treatment a previous time. So we know that if we can get a person through the door, matched up with an appropriate treatment, even if they don't do perfectly well that first time, if we make it easy, they will come back. And we're not alone. I mean, around the country, that's the, you know, physiological path of addictive disorders.
Talking again about opioids, which you mentioned again, methadone is one of the programs that you offer to help people off of opioids. Now, there has been in some quarters in the past a negative perception of methadone as a form of treatment for addiction. Is that still true today?
Oh, I think that methadone as a medication for the treatment of addiction is still highly stigmatized. I mean, I think it's becoming more acceptable because in the face of the opioid crisis that we have in the United States, we've really had to embrace methadone and other kinds of treatment with medications because, frankly, almost nothing else works, right? So if you have a person with a diagnosable opioid use disorder, the likelihood of that person entering a one-year period of non-opioid use without the use of a medication like methadone or buprenorphine is less than 90%, is less than 10%.
And what do the medications do? How does methadone help someone who is trying to kick an opioid habit?
From a physiological point of view, the most important thing that happens when you use methadone or we have another medication also used on an outpatient basis that's called buprenorphine, the use of which is also growing across the United States. They help a person stabilize and particularly help with the feelings of withdrawal and craving for whichever opioid the person is actually using. So the cravings go away, your physical symptoms, the feeling dope sick, as some people might call it, or the kind of physiological outcome of reducing opioid use is mitigated by methadone and by buprenorphine. And then the other thing that's really important with these medicines is that they really help you be stable. When you're using heroin, let's say, and you're using or any opioid and you use it 4, 5, 6 times a day, 4 or 5 hours go by, you start to feel bad, you need to use again, you know, so your whole day becomes about using these drugs and then feeling bad as they begin to wear off, needing to find more to use. Methadone and buprenorphine remove all of that. They're medications that really have the person in a stable state that's non-euphoric, and they really allow people to you know, go about their daily lives and function very well.
I'd like to ask you, too, about one of your clinics in the Hill North section of New Haven and some residents who live there that have been concerned about the people coming into their neighborhood to use the clinic. What have you heard about that?
Well, certainly I've heard what you all have heard, that there are some concerns from the neighborhood management team about people in the community and how they behave. I can tell you that that program has been in that neighborhood for 20 years. It has served a lot of people. There are a lot of other things that also going on in that neighborhood. It's a pretty densely populated part of the community. And while I'm sure it's true that sometimes people who use our treatment services, you know, are littering or loitering as they wait for the bus, it's not my experience that that is the primary difficulty in that part of the community.
I have another question about where clinics are located. Now, you mentioned that you do have clinics scattered around in various locations. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we hear about clinics like this and even other services, social services, the centers seem to be located in neighborhoods like the Hill. Do you think more suburban, rural locations, when it comes to the opioid problems, do you think more locations like that make sense, given that the opioid crisis is so widespread across many borders?
Yeah, I certainly do. And there's a couple of points I'd like to pull out of that question. It certainly is true that social service agencies like the App Foundation are located across the United States in historically in neighborhoods that are less affluent. And so therefore, those neighborhoods often do have a disproportionate burden of services among them. So I think that that's true. And I do think to the second part of your question, absolutely yes. People need to be able to access services where they live. And opioid use disorder is not solely an urban issue by any means. And frankly, if people can access services closer to where they live, they're more likely to be successful in treatment because the travel burden is lower on them. It's easier for them to continue their activities of their daily life and still get the medical care that they need.
Ms. Madden, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Tom. Take care.
Lynn Madden is the Chief Executive Officer of APT Foundation in New Haven. We're talking today on The Full Story about the opioid crisis and recovery services in Connecticut. Our next guest is New Haven Independent News reporter Tom Breen. He's been covering tensions in the Hill area of New Haven, tensions between residents and substance recovery services as demand for those services grow. The residents are particularly concerned about the building of a new recovery center. I spoke with Tom Breen via Skype, and I asked him to describe the Hill neighborhood for us.
So the Hill neighborhood is residential area. It's also the home to the growing kind of medical campus in the city. It's where Yale New Haven Hospital is located. It's where the Yale School of Medicine is. And it's also where a whole bunch of other non-Yale-related medical service providers are, including a few locations and campuses of the Cornell Scott Hill Health Center, which is a community health center that's been in the city for 50 years. So it's really a mix of residential and medical and a whole lot more.
And what's the source of the friction involving the clinics that work with people looking to deal with their opioid use disorders?
The project that we're talking about today is one undertaken by the Hill Health Center, again, a local community health center that is pretty beloved and has been in town for 50 years. They're looking to open a new, kind of build and open a new substance abuse recovery center on Cedar Street. But I would say when you talk about friction between the Hill community and substance abuse treatment centers, it's not actually Hill Health that most people complain about. It is an entirely separate organization called the APT Foundation, which is on Congress Avenue, about a half mile from where Hill Health is looking to open this new recovery center. The APT Foundation is a methadone clinic that is right across from a city public school, a K-8 school, that in the past 5-10 years, neighbors have consistently complained about people traveling from all over the region to the APT Foundation to get methadone treatment and then waiting and hanging out and loitering on the sidewalks and getting into fights, occasionally lethal fights. Someone was stabbed and ultimately died outside of the APT Foundation about a year and a half ago. And that all of this behavior is right across from a city school and something that kids on their way to school have to deal with is something that neighbors have complained about for a long time. So I think that this particular fight around a different organization looking to open a addiction recovery center, it is almost as much about an entirely separate organization in the APT Foundation as it is about Hill Health.
So then the friction itself really sounds like it predates the opioid crisis and the surge of people looking to find services to help themselves.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, again, the Hill is a predominantly black and brown, lower income residential community in the city. And because it is also the home to the kind of city's medical campus, there is an, at least the neighbors are arguing and have argued that there's an over concentration of social services and in particular addiction recovery services. Now, this is something that you hear in many neighborhoods in New Haven. New Haven, you know, having so many different nonprofits, so many different social services and actual budget for, you know, homelessness services in a way that I don't think any other city or town in Connecticut does. People say that as big-hearted as New Haven is and as progressive as a city it is, it also has to kind of bear the brunt of a lot of the region's kind of mental health and substance abuse addiction trouble. And much of that, especially when it comes to addiction recovery from opioid addiction or anything else, takes place in the Hill. Neighbors have pointed out that there are, I think I saw a list of something like 30 or 40 different similar social service providers in this area of the Hill. And neighbors are concerned that, again, they are bearing a disproportionate load of that burden.
In your reporting, have you had a chance to talk to the people who run the clinics, the facilities? What do they say about the concerns of the residents?
This Hill Health project in particular, there are a number of arguments they make. And I should say Hill Health has pretty firm support of city government behind them in opening this new center. It's really been a rising up of a group of neighbors in the Hill North area who have really put the brakes on it. But Hill Health argues, one, they've been in the city for 50 years. They treat predominantly low-income patients, many of whom are on Medicaid, and they have a pretty sterling reputation for being a good neighbor. They've been running this very addiction recovery program about a mile south in New Haven called the Grant Street Partnership. They're looking to relocate that service to this new prospective building on Cedar Street. They've never had any trouble with neighbors down on Grant Street. The only reason they're moving is because that city-owned building that they rent in is kind of falling apart, and they have an opportunity and some state bonding money to build this, you know, nice new facility. And also probably the most, you know, important argument that they make is that they're moving to a location right next to a methadone clinic that Hill Health already runs. So they're saying that we've already run this methadone clinic at this very site for 35 years and haven't had any complaints from neighbors. This new building that we're looking to put up would have behavioral health services, therapy, yoga, a whole bunch of other kind of supplemental kind of addiction recovery services that is right adjacent to an existing methadone clinic that they say hasn't presented any problem. So they want to consolidate. They say it'll be a nice new building. The neighbors are saying this is just going to attract too many more people with too many problems, again, right across the street from a school and a library and all the rest.
Could you elaborate? I was going to ask you, what would residents like to see happen? What have they told you?
Yeah, you know, this is it's a really interesting and messy and wonderful time in New Haven, in that there are all of these different examples of communities, particularly in the neighborhoods outside of downtown, where kind of everyday people are getting involved in kind of city administrative processes, going to city plan commission meetings and board of zoning appeal meetings, and really taking a very active role in understanding and trying to say what their neighborhood should look like. The neighbors have brokered a few agreements with Hill Health so far. They signed an agreement whereby they said they'd support the project if they got access to a kind of community meeting room that they could hold management team meetings in on a regular basis. But then the neighbors decided that that wasn't good enough. You know, we want some kind of monetary contribution from Hill Health on a regular basis towards after-school programs, towards workforce training programs in the neighborhood. We want, you know, some kind of active collaboration between Hill Health and these other social service providers so that they are making sure that they are not having a negative impact on the neighborhood. I think a lot of the neighbors I've spoken to feel somewhat resigned to the fact that this building is going to go in. There are too many people behind it, and there's too much money behind it to stop it entirely. So they're trying to figure out, how can we mitigate any potential negative impacts on the community, and how can we get as much as possible for people who have to live next to this for years to come?
You've anticipated my next question, which was, do you have a sense of what the residents are feeling about the future here, about what is going to happen? Do they feel they can make a real dent or even stop the building of this? But I guess they're kind of looking to get the best deal that they can.
Yeah, you know, I haven't spoken to anyone who really thinks that they can just flat out stop this. You know, none of the neighbors I've spoken to are against the mission of this addiction recovery center. And they say that, you know, they live in a city where they see people struggling with substance abuse addictions, and these services are as necessary here as anywhere else. What they're saying is that why does it always have to be in the Hill? And every neighbor I've spoken to said they are going to keep coming out and showing up and voicing their discontent and trying to hammer out an agreement with Hill Health. If this building's going to be built, they want to make sure that they kind of keep fighting to the end so that their neighborhood gets the best deal possible.
In your reporting on this story, especially dealing with people on the city level in city government, has there ever been any discussion about efforts to push the surrounding suburbs to house more of these clinics, more of these facilities?
Yeah, all the time. And I should say that, you know, Hill Health, both Hill Health and the Abbs Foundation do have some, you know, presence in the suburbs, even if some of their main locations are in New Haven. And this has also been, you know, a very big point of concern recently as city government in New Haven thinks about how to promote affordable housing development, preservation of existing affordable housing, but also encourage suburbs to build more affordable housing. And as you know, in Connecticut, we don't have, you know, regional government. So it's incredibly difficult for cities to actually, you know, leverage what political power they have in a state legislature that is overwhelmingly overrepresentative of suburbs and rural areas. So there is always talk at city government about how to go to the state to try to get the state to pressure the suburbs to build this in the outer rings instead of right where all the services are currently concentrated. But it's a very difficult fight because of, again, the disproportionate kind of lack of political power that a city like New Haven has in the state legislature.
Tom Breen is a reporter with the New Haven Independent. Mr. Breen, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for our show today. Associate producers are Sabrina Garone, Fatou Sangare, Roberto Rojas, and Desiree DiOrio. Carrie Frank is digital editor. J.D. Allen is producer. Ann Lopez produced today's program. Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Tom Kuser, sitting in today for Ron Ropiak. Thank you for being part of The Full Story.